This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll look at split-ticket voting when people share their ballot between Republicans and Democrats. First, in Wisconsin's race for governor, both candidates agree that more state funding needs to go to local police departments to address crime and public safety. But the style of their campaign's appeals on the issue couldn't be more different. Evan Casey reports.
You've likely seen the campaign ads by now. They're hard to miss.
We've witnessed a surge in crime, the theft, and shots fired.
Evers broke his promise. Now we're less safe than ever.
Tim Michaels will have our back.
And stand strong against violent crime.
In Wisconsin's gubernatorial race, Republican candidate Tim Michaels has blasted Democratic Governor Tony Evers for rising crime and said it would be one of his top priorities as governor. Evers has addressed the issue by pointing to spending increases he's made for local police departments across the state. No matter the candidate's approach, crime is one of the top issues that Wisconsin voters are focusing on this election. It's also a highly partisan issue. A Marquette University Law School poll found 74% of Republicans said they were concerned about crime, compared to just 38% of Democrats. Barry Burden is a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says Michael's campaign can benefit by attacking the incumbent on the issue.
As long as, you know, that is effective in reminding people about their concerns, maybe their fears about crime, it will maybe turn them against Governor Evers as they search for an alternative.
According to the State Department of Justice, violent crimes are up in recent years. Some national experts, and Evers himself, blame recent increases on the tumultuous pandemic years. But what can a governor do to address crime in a community? Kenneth Street is a law professor at UW-Madison. He says one method is a longer-term public health approach aimed at addressing the root causes of crime. Another approach? More state funding for local law enforcement.
If you were really going to have a vision as a governor, you'd say, I recognize that the local people have the best chance of understanding what kind of interventions could we do to turn it around.
Evers has said if he wins the race, he'd propose shared revenue increases for local governments. That plan includes $10 million for first responders. He's already allocated millions in federal pandemic relief funds for local police. The majority of those grants went to Milwaukee, which is seeing record numbers of homicides. Michaels has also committed to increasing state spending for local police, but he hasn't said how he'd pay for it. His Back the Blueprint plan calls for more police officers in, quote, dangerous neighborhoods across the state. That's encouraging to Andrew Wagner, the president of the Milwaukee Professional Police Association. That union endorsed Michaels for governor.
He doesn't want the status quo. He wants to increase that police force and make sure that the city has what they need to be safe.
But not everyone believes more cops is the answer. Angela Lang is the director of the Milwaukee-based community activist group Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC. She believes Michael's approach is the wrong one.
Some of the things that he supported, it feels very heavy-handed. It's very much, even if you go to his website, it's very much back the blue. Whereas in contrast, we see Governor Evers kind of lead with a more compassionate approach.
She wants to see more investment in public education, housing, healthcare, and mental health resources. Those are things Evers invested in with pandemic funds.
Those are what's going to help thriving communities and hopefully reduce crime as well.
Issues of crime and policing can be extremely contentious. And nowhere is that clearer than in the campaign's discussion of Kenosha in 2020. After a police shooting there, the city erupted in protests and riots that turned deadly. Michaels and other prominent Republicans have made an effort to blame Evers for what they say was a lack of leadership during the crisis. Others support Evers' decision. Kyle Johnson is BLOC's political director. He lives in Kenosha, and he says Michaels is using the incident to score political points.
It's hogwash. I mean, I have stronger language that I could use, but I won't because you're on radio. But honestly, it's dishonest, and it's hurting people. It's costing people their safety.
The candidates met for their only debate last Friday. Michael said if he was elected, there would be a, quote, new sheriff in town. On November 8th, the voters will decide for themselves. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, could Wisconsin see a rebound of split-ticket voting in this year's midterms? That's a possibility raised in a recent piece of political analysis in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Points to recent polling from Marquette University that shows Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson with a lead over his Democratic challenger. Same polls show Democratic Governor Tony Evers with a smaller lead over his Republican opponent. With partisanship on the rise, split-ticket voting has been declining for decades, but in a closely contested state like Wisconsin, a little bit can go a long way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you split your votes, picking and choosing? Republican here, Democrat there, or other in that other place? When is the last time you split your ticket in an election? Was it in the last election, 1980s, sometime in between, or are you party line all the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura Brown is a political scientist and author of Amateur Hour, Presidential Character and the Question of Leadership. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. It's great to be with you.
Now, you are particularly interested, I think, in states like Wisconsin with a statewide race for governor and a statewide race for U.S. Senate. Why is split-ticket voting so much on your mind this time around?
Well, I think it's on my mind because there are these states like Wisconsin that are so close and they are so competitive in both races. And what we see is that there have been some differences in the polling. We also know that voters sometimes think about a senatorial race or a gubernatorial race differently. They say to themselves, what issues are more likely to matter for a candidate who's going to Washington versus one who's staying home and looking after their state? So I think there are a lot of specifics and particulars with regard to this election. On the Democratic side, you can think about something like abortion that might push voters to actually vote Democratic at the state level, since that's now a decision at the state. But then, of course, the overall state of the economy, in the sense that that the Democrats and President Biden are not really caretaking the economy, and that inflation's a big issue, may be pushing some people to say, you know what, I want more Republicans in Washington. So I think there's a lot of cross pressures and a lot of specifics that could make a difference, even if it's just a small number of voters.
I think back to the 2018 election here in Wisconsin, where I was doing our election night coverage. At about 8 o'clock and 1 second, they called the race for Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat. She ended up winning by 11 points. Governor race, nail biter, Democrat Tony Evers wins by about 1%. Clearly, somebody was out there doing something other than going party line all the way.
Absolutely. I mean, I really do believe that there are voters who are both cross-pressured, and there are voters who really think about the candidate themselves. They aren't just focused on, say, the party line issues. They are trying to make the best choice with the best person. And even though it is a declining share of voters, and when we look to, you know, a couple of the races in 2020 where we saw this in New Hampshire and North Carolina, where opposite parties won each race, what you saw was that for the most part, it was popular incumbents who won each race, even though they were of opposite parties. And it was also clear that somewhere between about 3 to 7% of the voters in those races must have split their tickets. So this is where, again, you know, every vote counts, and it really will matter how close these races are on election day.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Three Lakes. Pat, hi.
Hi. I've been voting since Dwight Eisenhower. And it's kind of interesting that I split my ticket almost every time. And the reason I split my ticket is because I vote for the country. I don't vote for an individual. I think that's the democratic way to do things. I think it's, if you do your own research, there's no pressure on you because you know who you're voting for. And so if you're dumb enough to vote party line all the time, this is what you get. And I guess that's my comment.
Pat, thanks a lot. Now, I think there are more people unlike Pat these days, Laura, who are more prone to vote party line. But Pat, clearly a pick and choose candidate by candidate.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do believe that, you know, individual candidates matter. I mean, I wrote a book that is focused on presidential character for exactly that reason, that I do think that character says something about, you know, how that person is going to do the job, whether they have, you know, a Republican lean or a Democratic lean in terms of their issue positions, and they will be pressured by their parties. But I do think that it is not, and it should not be, kind of looked down upon by partisans for people to actually cast these sort of independent type votes.
When people analyze members of Congress, it seems like there's a trend where you have fewer, or basically no liberal Republicans, fewer moderate Republicans, no, or at least fewer conservative Democrats. Are the parties kind of sorting themselves out enough that may, in a way that might make split ticket voting less likely?
Well, the parties have certainly done that. We now see both Republicans and Democrats being much more ideologically and sort of consistent with their policies and their beliefs. So you have fewer, you know, kind of moderate or independent-leaning partisans affiliated with either party. But what has resulted is a larger number of Americans saying that they self-identify as an independent because of it. So the share of each party's voters in the overall electorate is actually going down, and the number of Americans who say that they think of themselves as independents has gone up and sustained in the, you know, mid-40s for quite a while now. And I think this really speaks to the fact that partisans should be more concerned about voters who are thinking about issues and are thinking about candidates as not being altogether one thing.
We're talking to political scientist Lara Brown about split ticket voting. When people vote for some R's, some D's, some G's or I's or L's too, maybe along the way on the ballot. And if that could change in this year's midterm elections, call it at 800-642-1234. Do you vote for individual candidates and you pick some from different parties? When's the last time you did it, if it's been a while? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about split-ticket voting. When someone votes, say, for a Republican in this race, a Democrat in that one, author and political scientist Lara Brown stays with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you split your tickets when you vote? Did you used to, but you don't anymore? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Superior. Scott, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I used to split my votes. I consider myself more financially conservative, but socially more liberal. But with a lot of like the misinformation and type of campaigns out there, I've found myself more on the social voting block, so more Democratic. And so I was wondering, how do we address that misinformation campaign? Because it's, to me, it misconstrues a lot of what both parties are talking about.
Scott, thanks for the call. Lara, misinformation in the election, Scott says that swayed him to stop splitting.
Yeah, I mean, really, what a fantastic question. I mean, I do know that there are so many people who feel as though they can't get good information anymore, because part of it has to do with the fact that a lot of legitimate and worthwhile media is actually subscription-based, and a lot of the kind of conspiracy-minded, all about the clicks and the grift is free and available on our social media feeds. So I do think that there is this very real problem where people are believing many things that are not true, and it's because it's difficult, more difficult than you would think it should be, to get good information easily.
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Appleton. Chris, hi.
Hi, thank you. I used to split my ticket. I made it a point to split my ticket. But I stopped doing that after our state was so gerrymandered after 2010. I just don't want that much power in control, or that much power to one party. Thank you.
Chris, thanks for the call. Chris, disillusioned by our gerrymandering in the state, Lara.
Yeah, well, you know, what is so interesting, and this gets to this difference between a governor and a senator, but it's also true at the House level or the state legislature. You know, when you're voting for a senator, you're not just voting for Senate, you know, so to speak. You are actually voting for the majority in the U.S. Senate, right? Your senator will contribute to or make up either the majority coalition or the minority coalition in the Senate. Whereas when you vote for governor, that person is an executive, and so they are singular. And I do think that, you know, voters who think about splitting their tickets, voters who consider something other than a party line strategy, are also thinking about that. They are saying to themselves, do I want this party or that party to be in control in a legislative body? And that's different than, do I want the governor's mansion to be run by one party or another?
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to political scientist Laura Brown about split ticket voting, when people vote for different parties on the same ballot, maybe one in a race for governor, one in a race for Senate. Still time for you to join in with your questions, your practices, if you're willing to share that. When it comes to ticket splitting, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Laura, one thing I wonder about with legislatures, as you were just talking about, the idea of if someone's voting for majority control, there's this concept of party discipline. How well do members of a party hold together to vote for something? You know, occasionally we get, you know, a Joe Manchin holding up this piece of legislation, or John McCain as senator holding up overturning Obamacare at one point. How much is that party discipline has changed? How does that affect that decision to vote for this candidate based on your hopes for party control?
Well, I do think that's a big part of what's going on. What we see is that legislation nowadays is really built, I would argue, from kind of the extreme ends of each party's coalition inward, rather than starting from the center and then building outward as they used to. And this is something that's been going on from the 90s. And I do think that this party discipline has also made it more difficult for people to want to split their votes, because they say to themselves, look, even if I vote for this person who says they want to be independent, when they get there, they're not going to be able to. And I know that, so I better, you know, cast my ballot all one way. And I, again, I mean, it's a fascinating moment we're in, because in some ways what we are seeing is so much of what we saw in the Gilded Age, before we could even do ticket splitting, because the parties actually printed and counted the ballots.
You are interested in Wisconsin, of course. We have close elections, so where ticket splitting could mean that we have a senator from one party, a Democrat from another. What are some of the other big states that are on your radar where split tickets could really sway things one way or another?
Well, certainly, I think nationally, everyone is looking at Arizona and Pennsylvania. Those are states where we saw, you know, President Trump kind of weigh in with his favored candidates. And those candidates are not faring as well in the general election as they did in the primaries. And there is this sense that you could see kind of opposite results in these states, though Pennsylvania appears to be leaning toward both Democrats winning, but certainly Josh Shapiro, who's running for governor, is much more favored over Mastriano than Fetterman is over Oz. And then I think you look at Arizona, where you can see that the Carrie Lake and Katie Hobbs' race for governor is much closer than the race for senator, where Mark Kelly is leading.
Now, part of all of these races will be decided by, you know, turnout. Democrats, do they show up? Republicans, do they show up? I want to talk about the independents. Sometimes I think in the media, I have the experience anyway of thinking, okay, well, there's Democrats, there's Republicans, and all these independents in between them in the middle. That's not really how it works, right? Like, we might have that socially liberal, fiscally conservative caller who agrees with one party on this, one on that. One might have a single issue that's important to them. What do we know about the independent voter and how they make these decisions?
Well, we don't know enough. I mean, the truth of the matter is independent voters and moderates are people who really need a closer study from political science. There is something of a consensus in political science that these people may just not be as interested in politics. But some of the more recent findings are that it may be more accurate to say they just think about politics differently. And whether they are sort of completely moderate across all of their issues or they have a mix of liberal and conservative issues, the general spectrum just doesn't suit them very well. And so this is where I would say, you know, the one thing that we do know is that these voters tend to make up their minds later in the process, so closer to Election Day, and it's often the reality that these voters do end up being decisive in who ends up winning the race. So I do think the parties should focus on them more. The candidates certainly should, and absolutely political scientists should as well.
Laura, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Laura Brown, political scientist and author of Amateur Hour, Presidential Character and the Question of Leadership. She is with us today to talk about the decline of split ticket voting and why it could still be a big deal in closely contested states like Wisconsin, with big races for governor and the U.S. Senate. If you have a history of voting split tickets, still love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Do you do it all the time, or do you remember the last time you did it? If so, how long ago was it? You can email ideas@WPR.org and let us know. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the Biden administration is taking a moonshot approach to look for cures for different kinds of cancer. Kate talked to the White House administrator of that program on tomorrow's show, along with a Wisconsin cancer expert. And you can join the conversation. As always, call in with your experiences and your question for Kate's guests. You can email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A couple weeks back, a guest on the show made the case that we should be more willing to do things that we are bad at. If you enjoy it, try it. Do it. I was off that day, but I thought it was interesting, and I gave it a try this week. I had the house to myself for a while, so I tried playing piano and singing. I'm not bad at playing the piano. I'm also not good at it. I'm mediocre. But when I start singing, my piano playing sounds pretty good by comparison. But I did it anyway. Figured out the chord progressions for a few songs, looked up the lyrics online, because I'm also bad at remembering lyrics, and I sang out loud at volume. There were no witnesses, and that's okay, because quality or not, I had a lot of fun. My set list included selections from Pink Floyd, Muse, and Sneaker Pimps. Here, I'll give you a sample of my singing. Oh, out of time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, we're not far out from Halloween. If you haven't yet declared October to be Scary Movie Month in your house, good news, there's still time and you've got a lot to choose from. Horror movies have been around for about as long as movies have been around. And from Frankenstein to Freddy Krueger, classic movie monsters and villains are part of our culture, or at least part of our Halloween costumes. Right now, we're looking at the history of the horror genre and celebrating some of the scariest movies of all time. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like scary movies? What is your favorite horror movie of all time? And what is it that makes a great scary movie? Is it the atmosphere, a great monster or villain? Do you like lots of violence in the movie or more suggestions of the scary stuff? Call it at 800-642-1234 if you avoid horror movies, too. Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gellies is an associate professor and director of film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's author of the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be here.
We've talked, Jocelyn, in the past about a bunch of different kinds of movies. I understand you're a particularly big fan of horror movies. What do you love about them?
I am a huge horror fan. There's a couple things I love about them. First, I was really scared of everything when I was a little kid, but I was also completely obsessed with horror movies. And I think I've just always loved that combination of fascination and total fear. But I also love that they can show us so much about what a society is feeling in terms of anxieties and fears. They really tell us about ourselves at particular moments in time.
Can you talk about some of the earliest milestones? Even before people started talking out loud in movies, we were still getting scared by them.
We totally were. Horror movies, they're one of the earliest genres that we see popping up once the feature length film comes into being. I actually just saw a week ago this Italian film Inferno from 1911, which is, as you might guess from the title of the film, it was an adaptation of Dante's Inferno. And it was actually the first feature length Italian film that was ever made. And basically, it is a 68-minute long silent horror movie. It is just images of hell, pretty grotesque for 1911. And I thought it was really fascinating to see that this first feature-length film from Italy was actually something that we might classify as a horror movie. And that's not just unique, of course, to that film. So I think about films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920, which is, of course, one of the hallmarks of German expressionist cinema and was so hugely influential both in Germany and across the world. And still really today, we still see the influence of that film. Filmmakers such as Tim Burton and Rob Zombie really took a lot from that movie. And then in the U.S., of course, we have films like The Phantom of the Opera and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, where we see the great Lon Chaney working his makeup magic in early horror films.
I think of the movie M with a very young Peter Lorre. I think that was a silent. It's been a while since I watched it. And it's the serial killer genre of horror movie. One thing I found watching that is, and maybe this is true for other movies, they set the stage, and so many movies have done similar things since then that it seemed like, oh yeah, it's the same old, because we've seen it 1,000 times, but that's just because they're so influential, right?
Exactly. And M is actually an early sound film, but okay. The sound is a little bit weird in it. It's very weird. So it's in that moment where like there's still early experimentation with sound. So it almost feels like a silent movie. It's a very strange, strange object. But yeah, M is such a great example of what would become such a massive serial killer genre. It's so utterly creepy the way that Peter Lorre plays that role. And I think we see so much there in terms of one's face, right? How much of a serial killer horror movie is about the face of the killer and what kinds of expressions that person makes. That really draws us into that psychological drama of the serial killer.
Now, we've had a lot of horror movie franchises, recurring characters, monsters. You let us know that Universal Studios in the 1930s was a big part of making that happen. I want to give a listen to Dracula, a 1931. Jonathan Harker has just shown up at the Count's castle.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
A classic moment. Can you talk about the importance of that movie and what followed?
Oh, absolutely. So that's, of course, the great Bela Lugosi that we heard as Dracula in the Todd Browning film from 1931. This is a moment when Universal Studios realizes that they have a gold mine on their hands, and that gold mine is the monster movie. So Dracula is one of the first really important ones. Fun little fact about Bela Lugosi's very preternatural makeup in that. It's a black and white film, of course, because it's 1931, but his makeup was actually green. And it was green to make it look like he was kind of luminous and otherworldly and glowing on screen. But just imagine being on set with Bela Lugosi saying that as he looks bright green. It's pretty funny. So that film is a really important one for Universal's foray into monster movies and becoming the kind of behemoth of a studio that it would become from then on out. Other important ones include Frankenstein from 1931, which is directed by James Whale. I absolutely love Frankenstein. I'd love even more Bride of Frankenstein, the sequel. Both are really exquisite films. And other films like The Mummy, also very important for the development of Universal's identity as a monster movie studio. But these movies are so beloved, and they become, all of them become franchises as well, right? Like there's multiple iterations of all of these films, and the monsters appear again and again and again. One of the things that's so interesting is that the monsters themselves become kind of beloved characters, right? It's not just that they're scary, it's that they're loved by the audiences. So we see this very early version of what will later be the horror movie franchise in Universal Studios.
We are talking about horror movies in the countdown to Halloween. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is with us from UW-Milwaukee, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite horror movie of all time? Classic or something you just saw that just came out this year? What do you like in a horror movie? Is there a particular type, a particular thing that gets you? Do you have a favorite vampire, a favorite Dracula? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Gabe on Facebook turns the clock ahead for us a little bit and said, when we asked about favorite horror movies, The Exorcist.
Oh my gosh, The Exorcist. That movie is so terrifying. I saw that as a teenager and I was raised Catholic and I was told never to play with Ouija boards, and I really believed it from that movie. That movie is so horrifying. It's especially scary, I think, because of the development of special effects that we see in that film. So the ways that like Reagan's head spins around, right? This is really, really genuinely horrifying. It's also a moment when this kind of violence and this kind of fear was available to be shown on screen in this kind of era of new Hollywood cinema in a way that it really hadn't before. So that's really a hallmark of so many aspects of horror movies in general, but it's absolutely terrifying.
I've talked to you about foreign films a lot. 1960s Japan, you say, is big on horror.
Absolutely. I think any horror fan should look a bit backwards into the 1960s in Japan. There's just an incredible amount of fantastic ghost stories in particular. So I think about, the first one I'd point to is actually not quite a ghost story, but it is a depiction of hell. It's called Jigoku. It's from 1960. And it's this, the main portion of the film is this really over the top elaborate descent into this hellscape that is one of the most terrifying and goriest things I've ever seen. And then you get other films like 1964's Kwaidan, which is an anthology of Japanese ghost stories done in really gorgeous, sumptuous color. It's very creepy, it's very folkloric, and it's just really fabulous. In 1968, there's a film called Kuroneko, or The Black Cat, which is just fabulous too, about these women who haunt these samurai. But one that I'd really like to alert listeners to, because they might not know about it, is from 1970, and it's called The Horrors of Malformed Men by Taro Ishii. And this movie is just kind of outlandish. It culminates in this sort of Island of Dr. Moreau imagery, where this mad scientist has created this race of strange beings on an island. But it's very informed by the post-atomic age in Japan, and it's very scary because it has that kind of that inkling of real life experience behind all of the fantasy and all of the horror.
We're talking to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, professor of film studies at UW-Milwaukee, getting some horror movie recommendations as we move toward Halloween. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite scary movie or kind of scary movie, or are there ones you just avoid? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about horror movies with Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, UW-Milwaukee film studies professor. It's Halloween time. What scary movies are you watching? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I was looking at the two movies called The Haunting, one in the 90s, which had a lot of special effects and everything, but the original for me in the 60s was eight times as good. It had Claire Bloom and Julie Harris, and you never ever saw the thing you were supposed to be scared of, which to me was twice as scary as a young person and even now.
Tom, thanks for sharing that. The Haunting, the earlier one, very atmospheric, as I recall, Jocelyn.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad that that film was brought up. It's of course based on the great Shirley Jackson's book, The Haunting of Hill House. And the amount of fear based on what is unseen and what is unsaid in that film, it is just palpable. I get shivers still thinking about it. I think that it really demonstrates the power of a film to not show you, right? Like what we don't see is much scarier than what we do see. It's very much in keeping with the tradition of horror literature as well, right? Like what is unknown is much scarier than what is known. So I think that's a great way that an adaptation from novel to screen can integrate those particular elements of horror, but transform it for the screen. I love that film.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Michael now in Kaukauna. Michael, hi.
Hey, I have a really weird and obscure movie. It actually became a series called Tremors, and I love it because it's horror, monster, sci-fi, and comedy all rolled into one, about these worms under the ground that come up and eat people, and then they transform into other creatures as the franchise moves on. And it's just, it's funny, it's horrifying, and it's exciting all at the same time. I wonder what your, if you're guess knew anything about it, heard about it, or could comment on it.
Mike, I remember Tremors. The first one was kind of a big deal anyway. Jocelyn?
Yeah, I totally saw the first one with Kevin Bacon, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think one of the, it's been a long time since I've seen it. I saw it when it came out. So this will be a bit out of left field for me. But I think one of the things that Tremors really encapsulated so well was this, this moment, this like American rurality, right? Because everybody's in the countryside, right? And so it's also about, I think there were doomsday preppers in it too. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a kind of wonderful depiction of different kinds of anxieties that were present in the United States, in the countryside at that particular moment in time.
Thanks for that call. Judy is with us now in Madison. Hi, Judy.
People probably wouldn't call this a horror movie, but it does have serial killers, and it has some pretty scary people like Peter Lorre in. But basically, it's a comedy, and that's Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, Judy, interesting. Now, I think, yeah, people class it as a comedy, but there's a lot of movies, Jocelyn, that take something horrifying, whether it's a serial killers or vampires or whatever, and play it for laughs.
Absolutely. There's a strong tradition of the combination of comedy and horror. And they tie in so well together because both of them make us have some kind of bodily reaction, right? We might scream in horror. We might laugh in comedy. They fit together really, really nicely. So if you think about something like the Evil Dead trilogy, right? Those are, to me, these kinds of like texts of comedy horror because you're horrified, you're so grossed out and you're scared, but then you're laughing because of ridiculous lines. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Sam Raimi, who made the original Evil Dead movies, he was not at first interested at all in horror movies. He was much more interested in comedy, but saw horror as a way to make a quick profit. So that's why he started making horror movies. I think there's traditionally a lot of complementary aspects of comedy and horror genres.
Judy, thanks for calling at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us now in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. Say, a movie that I discovered recently is Let the Right One In, the Swedish movie, I believe, or Norwegian. And I love it because it's like a 10-year-old boy who befriends a vampire. And the vampire kind of becomes his savior and teaches him how to deal with bullies and stuff. And it's really an interesting movie.
Brian, thanks. Jocelyn, Let the Right One In.
Such a beautiful film. I agree so much. One of the things that is so fascinating about the depiction of that relationship in the movie is that it's really from the perspective of the children, of the main child, and then the vampire who's also a child. But it's such a beautiful, chilly, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous film. So I too really, really love that film.
Brian, thanks for that call. We are talking about horror movies, and you could share yours at 800-642-1234. If you have an all-time favorite, Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is with us from the UW-Milwaukee Film Studies Department. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Dwayne is with us in Weston. Dwayne, hi.
Hey, hi. A lot of good comments. I think Let the Right One In is called Let Me In, I believe. That I love that one. Chloe Grace Moritz was in that. Mm-hmm. But I was going to say The Shining. My son and wife were just out in Colorado at Estes Park and actually went to the Stanley Hotel. Stephen King went there that night with his wife, stayed there, got his inspiration. And it was actually the bartender there that wouldn't take his money because all the books were closed for the year. But and then there's a one out right now called The Black Phone that is just really good. And then, of course, the other heavy hitters are The Sixth Sense, The Omen. Yes, they give me the creeps.
Gotcha, Dwayne. Thanks for the call. Let's go to the Stanley Hotel and The Shining, Jocelyn.
Yeah, The Shining is, of course, a classic. I will say that Let Me In is the American remake of Let the Right One In. They're both actually excellent. But yeah, The Shining is a classic for so many reasons. I think one of the reasons that it has such a lasting impact is because the legend around, you know, how it was filmed and the kind of traumas that everybody went through on set, that ends up kind of infecting how the movie enters into a larger cultural consciousness too. I think about another film like Poltergeist and the Poltergeist franchise, which also entered into the cultural consciousness, not just based on being scary films, but based on the loss of the young actress who played the little girl in them, right? She had she experienced this early death, which was very, very tragic. And that then ends up making the films have a larger presence in American culture writ large. So I think The Shining is another great example of that.
Thanks for the call, Dwayne. Pam joins us now in Sister Bay. Pam dropped. Okay, instead, let's hear a little taste of music that will be instantly recognizable to any fan of the movie. Here we go. All right, The Thief from Halloween, the movie by John Carpenter, the music by John Carpenter. I used to be really big into John Carpenter horror movies. Jocelyn, you're a fan too.
I was going to be really disappointed if the Halloween music didn't just play, Rob.
Me too.
yeah, I'm a huge John Carpenter fan, and he's had such an impact, not just in terms of the look of his films and, you know, the structure of his films. The Thing, of course, as like a survivalist horror film, there's no comparison. It's just absolute perfection still. But it's so incredible that his music has also had this lasting impact, not just in the films themselves, but then how in other filmmakers take on that same kind of synthesizer sound. So something like It Follows, just from, I think 2014 is when It Follows came out. That, of course, draws entirely on the John Carpenter sound for developing its own soundtrack and score. So he's had such a lasting impact in so many weird ways. And music, I think, is such a funny one. But that's such a, you know, it's just such an important touchstone for how we understand horror movies to sound.
All right. And I think we actually do have Pam in Sister Bay. That was my mistake. Pam, hi.
Hi. I love horror movies so much, and I'm always looking for new ones to watch. But one that I always go back to is Rosemary's Baby.
Why? Why do you keep going back to that one, Pam?
I know you were going to ask me that. Honest to God, I don't know why. I just think it's so well done. And I love that she knows something's going on, but she pursues through the whole thing and she doesn't let it drop. That's all I can say.
Interesting, Pam. Thanks so much. Jocelyn.
Oh, yeah, Rosemary's Baby. It is fantastic, and it is so scary. And one of the things that's so interesting about it is that it's so much about a woman's experience, even though it's directed by a man, right? And it is just like an absolute touchstone for how one approaches the horror of being, of feeling like you're alienated from everybody in your life, feeling gaslit, right? Like nobody is listening to you. It's just an absolutely fabulous, fabulous film. I would point to a very contemporary film that does deal with women's experiences that is actually directed by a woman that the listeners might not all be familiar with. It's called Relic. It's from 2020. It's an Australian film. And it's about three generations of women who've come together in this house, and the grandmother has dementia, but also there's somebody haunting the house. And it's just an incredible depiction of what it's like to go through a loved one being diagnosed with dementia, as well as those kinds of ties between female generations that really are, that really can never be totally sundered. It's a beautiful, scary, and wonderful film about women's experience.
We'll leave it there. Jocelyn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee. Keep sharing your horror movies on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow, Food Friday, Jacques Pepin. Cooking chicken, painting chicken, that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.